from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Ben Sidran is a jazz legend, a pianist and composer who's played with just about everyone and recorded 30 solo albums. But he's also a scholar with a particular story he's long wanted to tell. It's the subject of his recent book, There Was a Fire, Jews, Music, and the American Dream. And it traces the intersection between American Jews and American popular music, a story arc that includes much of the American songbook, from Irving Berlin and George Gershwin to Barbara Streisand and Bob Dylan. We'll talk with Ben Sidran and hear some of that music next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. That's Ben Sidran, legendary jazz pianist and composer who's not only recorded over 30 solo albums, he's also produced the work of Diana Ross, Mose Allison, Van Morrison, and many others. Sidran co-wrote Space Cowboy with Steve Miller, composed the music for the acclaimed documentary Hoop Dreams, authored 3 books, and has a PhD. In short, Ben Sidran is annoyingly accomplished. But despite that sizable body of work, there was still one story that Sidran had always wanted to tell and sing for a very long time. And now he has. It's the subject of his recent book, There Was a Fire, Jews, Music, and the American Dream. The book traces the influence and interplay between American Jews and American music from Irving Berlin to Bob Dylan and beyond. But it's also a story about identity, meaning, and belonging. And Ben Sidran joins us in this hour now to talk about that story and to play some of that music as well. Ben, good morning. Pleasure to talk with you again.
Thank you, David. Good morning to you.
I want to start, if we might, by a story you tell in the book early on about an iconic American song, and for what to me was an unlikely, perhaps, but perhaps likely in the end, origin. It's a story about what happened in the early part of this century when a Jewish newspaper in New York decided they wanted to inform Jewish immigrants about this American thing called baseball. So pick up the story from there, if you will.
Well, between 1880 and 1920, several million Jewish refugees from the Pala settlement, dirt poor, came to the United States and very much wanted to become American, Americanized. And so the Forward, or the Fubitz as it was called, the Yiddish newspaper in New York, decided to run a series about baseball, this great American game. And so I would imagine most of the Jews who read about it had never been to a baseball game. That was the case with one such immigrant. His name was Albert von Tilzer. Actually, Albert von Tilzer, to be completely frank, started out in Milwaukee, but his family was Jewish. And he came to New York in order to participate in the music business that was burgeoning there among Jewish immigrants. And so, having read this article in the Forward, he wrote a song about baseball. And you can just imagine, you know, him sitting there, you know, strike one, strike two, strike three, what's it going? Okay. So he wrote this song about baseball. And when you listen to the lyrics, you know, it's hard not to be struck by the fact that it's really not just about baseball. It's about longing. It's about being part of a crowd that'll have you. It's about being lost in a crowd. You know, sometimes people say, you know, the Jews want to invent a crowd in which to be lost in, but they want the crowd to be a crowd of outsiders. Mm. So it's this very complex weave of history and sociology and a longing for social justice that you can hear sometimes if you listen carefully in the song Take Me Out to the Ball Game.
Let's listen to your version of that song.
Take me out to the ball game. Take me out to the crowd. Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jack. I don't care if I never come back, 'cause it's root, root, root for the home team. If they don't win, it's a shame. It's one, it's two, it's three strikes, and you're out at the old ball game.
Such a great song, and I had no idea of its origins. And say more, though, if you would, Ben, about your take on that, that it's really about a certain kind of longing.
Well, it's the reason that I play it as a waltz, as kind of a romantic waltz, because there's inherent in a lot of Jewish popular music every cloud has a silver lining, every silver lining has a cloud. It's the context of minor and major, of sadness and happiness, that Shostakovich called the Jewish penchant for smiling through the tears. And to find it in a song like Take Me Out to the Ball Game was kind of revelatory for me. I mean, you slow it down, you play it a little romantically, and there it is. There's a heartfelt Jewish song.
And so what makes a Jewish song?
Well, that's a very good question. As I say, there are no Jewish notes on the piano. They all have 88 notes. And when you look at it, you know, it's not just music written by Jews, or Jews can write any kind of music. It's not music written for Jews. You know, it's hard to pin down. But this contextualizing of the major and the minor, I think, is at the heart of it. It's something that Cole Porter, who, of course, was not Jewish, said he had to master in order to write successful music. He said he learned how to write Jewish. And in a lot of his songs, what you hear is a minor passage complemented by a passage that goes into a relative major key in the bridge. So a lot of people think that Jewish music is sad music. It's minor. That's really not it. It's just a part of the process. The process is this contextualizing, and I think it's very important to see that as part of the Jewish process. You know, the Jews are the children of the book, and everybody assumes the book is the Torah. But the book, I think, is really the Talmud, which is the commentary on the Torah. The Jews are interested in the discussion. They're not interested in the answer. So the music presents both sides, up and down, light and dark, good and bad. And it's this mix that makes it feel real to us as listeners, and it makes it talk to us on a very personal level.
I want to play something else. This is from the great composer Irving Berlin. It's your version of Blue Skies, and there are a number of questions about it in the context of what you were just saying. But let's listen to a little of it first, and then we'll come back and talk more.
Blue skies smiling at me, there's nothing but blue skies. What do I see? Bluebirds singing a song, nothing but bluebirds all day long. Never saw the sun shining so bright, never saw things going so right. Noticing the days hurrying by, you're in love, how they fly with blue days, all of them gone. Nothing but blue skies from now on.
So, Ben, tell us what's going on in that song, both the use of language and what's happening musically.
Well, exactly. You know, in the middle section, the bridge, never saw the sun shining so bright, never saw things going so right. The chords there alternate bar by bar, minor, major. Never saw the sun, minor, going so right, major, back and forth. And so you get this kind of context of emotional movement that touches our heart instead of our head, you know. It engages us. It pulls us in. But more than that, the language that Irving Berlin uses is really remarkable. When you consider that he was born in Siberia, he came to the United States as a young boy. Yiddish was his first language. He wrote some of his songs at age 19, 20, 21, 22 years old. And he totally captured the American idiom, the idiom that was spoken on the streets. Up until Berlin and this whole aggregation of Jewish writers, American music was primarily a bad version or clever take on Gilbert and Sullivan, British music hall music, Viennese waltzes. It wasn't so much American. The 19th century American popular culture was looking across the ocean. But in the 20th century, this American popular culture became invented, and it crossed the world. You know, Irving Berlin told a story about how when he went to Europe, they were playing one of his songs, Alexander's Ragtime Band, everywhere he went. Hmm. This American music, music that was peculiarly American, completely captured the world. And if you look at the 20th century, it really is our primary export to the world. It's how the people all around the world have discovered us during the wars, during peace. And Berlin's language, which swings, which is street, American street, was profound at the time.
And you make the argument, and you say it a bit tongue-in-cheek, but that 2% of the population, meaning the Jewish population, is responsible for 80% of American popular music.
Well, you know, that's the statistic that I both made up and started me on my journey. I didn't make up the 2%. The Jews have never been more than 2% of the population of the United States. But the 80%, I mean, you can't possibly know what percentage literally was contributed by the Jews. But if you consider the publishers, the writers, the composers, the promoters, the producers, the performers, it's extraordinary. It's extraordinary. It's way outside the curve of chance. There's something going on here. And that's
what is that? Yeah, what is that? Why would that have that sort of exponential effect?
Well, I think it's actually a lot simpler than people think. I think it's about narrative. I think it's about story. I think the Jews really contribute a great deal to what we consider the American dream. If you think about what the American dream has become, not just here but around the world, you know, it's really about the poem on the Statue of Liberty. Give us you're tired, you're poor, the tempest tossed, you know. And that poem was written by Emma Lazarus, a Jewish girl. And up until that time, the Statue of Liberty was really about free trade. It was about the economy. The Jews made it about social justice. And I think when you look at popular music in America, it's not all about social justice, but it's very much about the people's story. And the American dream is very much about how we can pull together and the rising tide lifts all ships. And remember, you too were a stranger in a strange land. This idea of compassion that has become cliched in terms of how we negotiate our foreign policy these days is a Jewish ideal originally. And because the Jews were so influential in popular culture, not just music but films and literature, that the Jews, through their work and not necessarily knowingly, quite probably inadvertently, have created this America.
You cite one example of social justice, and I honestly don't think I'd ever really seen the lyrics. But let me just read these from a very famous song. They used to tell me I was building a dream with peace and glory ahead. Why should I be standing in line just waiting for bread? Once I built a railroad, I made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once I built a tower up in the sun, brick and rivet and lime. Once I built a tower, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Those lyrics really speak to that central message of social justice. And is it, again, part of that story that Jews came here and came and, like many immigrants, were at the bottom, but were also looked at in a different way as being sort of strangers in a new land? And is that what made that connection to that mission of social justice?
I'm sure that facilitated it, but I think the mission of social justice goes all the way back. You know, it's at the heart of the Jewish narrative. You know, I like to say either God exists, which is a miracle, or God doesn't exist. And if that's the case, we worship a narrative. And it's a bigger miracle, perhaps, that this story, this narrative, has moved so much history over the thousands of years. That Jewish narrative the sentiments in Brother Can You Spare a Dime go back hundreds, thousands of years into the Jewish experience. But those little rhymes that Yip Harburg made were revolutionary in that at the time there had never been a popular song that so obviously addressed social injustice. And this was in the 30s, of course. And around the same time, you know, Jerome Kern did Showboat, which was also revolutionary in that the curtain goes up and you see a whole stage full of African Americans singing a song about the river, and the river was a metaphor for America. And these were revolutionary ideas and presentations of who we were at the time. Popular culture before that didn't take that into account.
Ben Sidran, our guest this hour. He will be in the Bay Area next week performing. Ben will be at Yoshi's in Oakland next Wednesday at 8 o'clock, and then the next day he'll be at Sweetwater's in Marin. So next week, Wednesday and Thursday, opportunities to hear Ben perform again. His book is There Was a Fire, Jews, Music, and the American Dream. Let's pursue that question that you just raised about this connection that has been both one of intimacy and one of tension between American Jews and blacks. And to get us into that topic, tell us a little bit about the song, and then we'll hear a version of it, Alexander's Ragtime Band by Irving Berlin.
Well, this was his first hit. This was written when he was like 19 years old. And as I said before, it's really remarkable that this young man, whose first language was Yiddish, could come up and make a street-level song about ragtime. Now, first of all, the song is not ragtime. Irving Berlin couldn't really play piano, and he didn't understand ragtime even if he could play piano. Ragtime was a piano idiom that came out of Sedalia, Missouri, you know, the piano professors. And it was very much an articulated, educated black form, a pianistic form. And the thing about ragtime, well, to rag a piece of music, originally that was a verb. Rag was a verb. It meant to swing. And ragtime would take popular songs or original songs and syncopate them. Syncopate them, meaning throw the emphasis to the weak beat, and so subsequently it would feel like your heart does. Your heart beats as a dotted eighth, ba-bum, ba-bum, ba-bum. That swings. That's kind of ragtime. And Irving Berlin didn't know about that, but he understood that this ragtime, the term rag, was a code word for black music, black Americans, the black experience. And at the turn of the century, the black experience was really exotic, and it was very attractive to those Americans who were interested in becoming modern. Understand that this is a period where Victorianism was still in charge, and you know, they were shutting down taverns because the men weren't coming home, and everybody wanted everybody else to be middle class, and everybody was striving to be part of this middle class. And so ragtime was kind of exotic. You might even think of it as the early rock and roll of the time, you know. It appealed to fun lovers. And so Berlin tried a lot of things before he got his hit. You know, I mean, we know of his hits, but we don't necessarily know of his misses. Yiddle on your fiddle, play some ragtime, you know. But he wrote this song, and what did it was the language swings. And the language that not just Berlin, but a lot of these Jewish composers came up with were remarkable in that, just like Gershwin's language in Porgy and Bess, you know, some of these songs. They sound authentically black and or street, American black or American street. And it's not just imitation. It's something else. It's a deeper understanding of the popular idiom. And so Alexander's Ragtime Band was an enormous, enormous hit, and it launched this 19-year-old kid on his way.
Let's listen to the Ray Charles version of Alexander's Ragtime Band.
Come on in here, come on in here, Alexander Ragtime Band. Come on in here, come on in here, the best band in the land. They can play a bugle call like you never heard before.
so natural that you want to go to war. It's just the bestest band, whatever. Oh, honey lamb, come on along, come on along. Let me take you by the hand to meet the man, to meet the man who's the leader of the band. And if you want to hear that Swanee River played in a ragtime, come on.
So, Ben, is it, it's that come on along, come on along?
Well, that's what Berlin said, that the song opened with this great welcome to everybody, this great come on along, everybody's welcome. He thought that was the hook that brought people in. And Berlin also famously said, the mob is never wrong. Hmm. If people like it, it's good. He was into writing hit songs, and he struck the formula with this.
And what was... what was black, I guess, about that song again? Tell us sort of why that was, to you, authentically black.
Well, you know, the song itself is not black. It references black American culture in the idea of ragtime and also in this kind of crazy offhand reference to the Swanee River. You know, the Swanee River was first mentioned by Stephen Foster 50 years before this. And Berlin, like all these Jewish composers who came from the Pale of Settlement in the United States, idolized Foster because he had hit songs, you know, Oh Susanna and Old Black Joe and I Dream of Jeannie. And so in one of these songs, you know, Foster refers to way down upon the Swanee River, right? Well, the truth is that the Swanee River was not much of a river. It was like a little muddy creek down in Florida that Foster just needed a two-syllable name for a river to throw into a song. He went to an atlas. He saw the Swanee River, and he threw it into a song. But all these Jewish songwriters just assumed they'd never been south of you know, the Bronx or Brooklyn, and they just assumed this was a great river. So he throws in the Swanee River played in ragtime, you know. He's trying to connect to this image of a pastoral American history that we could all be part of.
And we have to go to a break in just a moment. But there are these other songs, Shine On Harvest Moon, Carolina On My Mind, that right. that are from Jewish composers. And again, it's about that search for home.
Yeah. I mean, and you can find it in other songs as far away as, you know, Irving Berlin also wrote God Bless America and White Christmas. And if you listen to White Christmas, that's a song about nostalgia and home, too. I'm dreaming of a white Christmas, just like the ones I used to know. It's not about today. It's about this nostalgia for a past. The Jews desperately wanted to feel they were at home.
Ben Sidran joining us this hour again. Ben will be performing at Yoshi's in Oakland on April the 10th. That's next Wednesday. And then he will be at Sweetwater's in Marin on Thursday. His book again, There Was a Fire, and we'll hear that story. Ben will tell the story of the fire when we return. There Was a Fire, Jews, Music, and the American Dream. When we return, Ben joins us this morning from the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we'll also take your questions when we come back. We'll listen to more of Ben's music. And if you have questions about the relationship between American Jews and American popular music and the subject of American Jews and blacks, and which has been both a relationship of intimacy and tension, we'll get into that as well. 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Ben Sidran joins us this hour, the legendary jazz pianist, composer, record producer, author, scholar. His latest book, There Was a Fire, Jews, Music, and the American Dream. Ben joins us this morning from Madison, Wisconsin. He'll be performing in the Bay Area next week, Wednesday at Yoshi's, Thursday at Sweetwater's in Marin. You can join our conversation at 866-733-6786. Email us your thoughts at kqed.org or post them on our Facebook page or on our website. Number of comments coming in, Ben. Bonnie writes, I just had one of those aha moments listening to Ben Sidran's commentary. His His insightful comments ring so true. As someone with only a little bit of musical training, this understanding increases my appreciation. Namaste and shalom from Rick, who writes, "Thank you, Ben, for one of my favorite and inspirational albums, Life's a Lesson, over the past 20 or so years. I've given it to Jews as far afield as England, Romania, Turkey, and Israel. And I heard that you play that at Yom Kippur services in Madison. I wish I could be there to hear that." Tell that story. It's an interesting one, Ben, about your recording of that music and your struggles to get it distributed.
Life's Lesson is a record of Hebrew liturgical music that I recorded in 1992 or 3. And it came out of this local gathering that we do for the High Holidays here in Madison every year. Services led by a woman named Hannah Rosenthal. I do the music, and every year we just sort of rent a space, which actually coincidentally was a synagogue built in 1860, but it's a public building now. And we throw open the doors to anybody who doesn't have another place to go for the holidays or wants to join us. And we do services that are slightly alternative, as you can imagine, this being Madison. And so I do the music. And I found it was just wonderful to get back in touch with these songs, Eliyahu Hanavi, Avinu Malkeinu, Osei Shalom, these songs that I knew as a kid. There was something magical when I would play these songs that I hadn't thought about, you know, in 40 years or something. And I just fell in love with it. And eventually, I decided to record a whole record of these songs using Jewish musicians from around the country.
Ben, let's just play a little bit of Eliyahu from one of your performances, and then I want to hear more about the struggles to distribute this music. But let's listen to a little of that.
Eliyahu Hanavi. Eliyahu Hatishbi. Eliyahu, Eliyahu. Hagiladi. Bimhera. Be'aminu Yavo Eleinu Imoshiach Ben David Imoshiach Ben
So, Ben, first tell me what it feels like to play that music for you.
Well, first of all, I'm humbled that you played that. What it feels like is I'm really walking on very thin ice. It goes back to all the issues and questions and doubts of growing up a Jew in a small Wisconsin town, not very unlike the town where Bob Dylan describes as where you can see the northern lights and there are bears in the woods, you know. So it's very difficult, actually, for me to do a song like that. And I can hear it in my voice. It was a tough thing to do solo. On the record, I would like to point out, we have the L.A. Philharmonic on violins and Lee Konitz and Josh Redman on saxophones, and there's no hesitation. But for me personally to do this music is still every time it's like treading thin ice.
I want to turn, if I might, before we talk more about your struggles to get some of that music distributed, because a couple of people have written in, and we should get to this, about the relationship between blacks and Jews. Someone, Thusi writes in, "Whoa, is Sidran claiming that Jewish people contributed 80% of pop music? plenty of black artists were robbed by white managers and rival composers, many of them Jewish. And we have a caller who wants to talk about this question as well. So let's hear from our next caller, Cartman, and then get your thoughts in response to that sort of more darker, more tension filled part of this subject. Cartman, go ahead, please.
Oh, hi. Thanks so much. First, I want to say I love Forum. I've been listening forever, my whole life. I love you guys. And this show is so beautiful. Thank you. Here's my question. And yes, I wanted to touch on that. I noticed, like, for instance, even like I love a lot of hip hop. And this is so good, following on the tail of that individual's email. Like, of course, the really famous one is No Vaseline by Ice Cube, when, you know, you let a Jew split us up. And I oftentimes have these conversations with friends, and what I always say is, yes, Jews, Christians, people of all backgrounds have definitely done this. But I notice whenever friends of mine will say, we make reference to something like that woman did in her email, they'll make reference to, if it's a Jewish person, they'll say, many Jews did this, or a Jew did that. But they won't say, a Christian did this, or a Christian did that. So it just seems like this real, like, incredible hostility. When I point that out to friends of mine, they'll say, and then when I give them the particulars, I'm saying, you know, I'm not saying that this particular person who is or was Jewish did this, but what about this person who was Christian? They'll just say, well, yeah, I guess so. They'll kind of brush it off. So definitely, like, some serious, serious hostility going on. Anyway, thank you so much. One more thing, as far from someone who celebrates Easter and Passover, happy post-holidays.
Okay, thanks, Carmen. Ben, chime in, please. Yeah.
Well, yes, this is a subject that is fraught, has been fraught, and, you know, it doesn't trouble me as much as it troubles a lot of people. I'll tell you why. Because first of all, the connection between blacks and Jews in America is key. It is the reason we have popular culture. There would not be popular culture without African Americans, nor would there be popular culture as we know it without the Jews. That's the first thing. And whereas it's true that the blues form and this melodicism that comes from an African American culture is a key to jazz presentation, so is the harmonic foundation of the Great American Songbook, which was primarily contributed by Jews. Without one, you would not have jazz. Without the other, you would not have jazz. They stand together just as blacks and Jews for years have stood together. And black musicians, Max Roach, the great black drummer, once said to me, you know, jazz is the only truly American art form there is. Look at the drum kit. You get one drum, the tom-tom that comes out of Africa. You get another hi-hat cymbal that comes out of marching bands. It's an American form. And I think that's the first thing to say. Second thing to say is that even during the 40s, and that's where this question goes back to, because up until the 30s, the major record labels recorded everybody, black and white, and essentially promoted who they chose to, who they could make money with. If they could make money with Bessie Smith, they would. In the 30s, because of the Depression, the major labels dropped what they called race music. Race music was not just black music. It was all sorts of music. It was German music, you know, anything that had a small market, what we would call mid-level today. And that was picked up by many Jewish entrepreneurs. Remarkably, all of them were Jews. They started these little labels and they started recording all these black artists. Now, yes, it's true that a lot of people didn't get paid royalties, but it's not just the black people that didn't get paid the royalties. Nobody got paid royalties because there wasn't a lot of money involved, first of all. There's no conspiracy here. The Jews didn't pay the Jews. The Jews didn't pay the blacks. There wasn't that much money. These guys drove around in their cars, some of them very well-intentioned, great fans of the music, some of them just in it because they had an injection molding machine and they wanted to use it.
And where did it come apart, Ben? Where did what was once largely collegial and collaborative, where did that come unstuck?
Yeah. Well, before I answer that, let me just say that the song Strange Fruit, which was written by a Jewish leftist and recorded by Billie Holiday, and was not long ago voted the song of the century. That's a classic example of a Jewish composition, a black voice, and a paean for social justice.
Let's listen to a little of it, Ben, and then I'll come back and ask you to comment more.
All right.
southern trees bear strange fruit. Blood on the leaves and blood at the root. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees.
Billie Holiday singing Strange Fruit in the late 1930s. Ben.
Well, now that song, as I say, was written by Abe Mirapol, who was a schoolteacher in New York, and he worked very hard to get the song to Billie Holiday. She turned him down a couple of times. Eventually, Milt Gabler, who started one of these small record labels to pick up where the large ones left off, convinced Billie Holiday to record it on his label, Commodore Records, and it became a phenomenon. The idea that this then became associated with Billie, people thought she wrote it, people thought it was written for her, became legendary, and eventually people started saying, who is this person who claims the rights to this song, Mirapol? So it got completely flipped around. To answer your question, where did it go wrong? And it's gone totally and terribly wrong. And to me, it's the great crisis of the 20th century. I mean, I'm old enough to have spent a lot of time with black musicians, white musicians, rural musicians, urban musicians, and the collegiality among musicians is the main thing I remember. The bigger the musician, whether Dizzy Gillespie or whoever it was, the more generous they have been, not just with me, but with all young musicians trying to come up and trying to do something. But I guess you could say it started, the rot set in the late 60s. And a lot of people have a lot of theories. One theory is that it was a fallout from affirmative action, because there were a lot of conservative Jews who were against affirmative action in the late 60s. They were against affirmative action in part because if you single out a group, a race, for one thing, you can single them out for anything. And that is, in fact, what happened to the Jews in Germany, in Nazi Germany. They were singled out. So the idea of affirmative action scared some people at the root level. But there are other things, too. You know, this idea of militancy spilled over into the business in really not nice ways. For example, Jerry Wexler, a great Jewish record producer, who almost single-handedly, I mean, he recorded Ray Charles, the original Ray Charles stuff, the Aretha Franklin stuff, brought a great deal of black music to American popular culture. And it's important to remember that even guys who maybe were not well-motivated captured and preserved a lot of this culture that would have gone away. You know, so if we step back, we see that this relationship is a profound one, and it can't be simply summed up in the kind of cliches that you hear in the rap culture. You know, I mean, I could go on a bit about the rap industry and the fact that, you know, this is not devoid of Jews. Rick Rubin, who is one of the premier rap producers, a Jewish gentleman, claims that it's okay to say anti-Semitic things if it makes it real.
Is it repairable, Ben? I mean, and if so, what are you trying to do in that regard?
Boy, oh boy, David. It a question like that makes me drop my professional facade. Do you know what I mean? It's really something. I wish I could communicate how important the relationship of blacks and Jews have been in my life, how the spiritual nature of the encouragement I've gotten from black musicians has led me in some ways back to my own Judaism and the idea of the importance of having some spiritual center in your day-to-day existence. And I'm so viscerally upset by things like Just one thing. I mean, if I refer to Spike Lee's Mo Better Blues, a vicious, vicious anti-Semitic story. Unnecessary. Because the truth of it is, yes, there are bad guys. There are bad guys everywhere. You know, it's not a black thing or a white thing. It's a human thing. And this whole experience leads me back to the realization that I had when I was 13 years old. I was listening to a Horace Silver record, like an Eskimo huddled around a fire in my living room. And I fell in love with it. And I thought they were talking to me. And I thought these musicians were related to me somehow. And when I found out they were all black, my first thought was, well, you know, there's only the human race. There's not a black race and a white race. There's the human race. And everything else is local color. We're in it together. So can it be healed? Well, that leads us to the there was a fire story, doesn't it?
Yeah, I was just going to go there. Go ahead.
The reason the book is called There Was a Fire is because it's a story about the Baal Shem Tov, the famous Jewish rabbi back in the Pale of Settlement. And one day his community was in trouble. And so he went into the woods and he found a special place and he lit a special fire and he said a special prayer and the community was saved. The next generation, the Baal Shem Tov, is no longer with us, but the rabbi who was there, his community is in trouble. So he goes into the special place in the forest. He lights the special fire, but he's forgotten the special prayer. He says to himself, maybe it's sufficient, and it was, and the community was saved. Next generation, of course, there's always problems in the community. The rabbi's always trying to solve it. This guy goes into the woods. Now he knows the special place. He can't build the special fire. He doesn't know the special prayer. He said, well, maybe it's sufficient, and it was, and the community was saved. So you know where this is going. Finally, four generations later, the community's in trouble. The rabbi goes into the woods. He doesn't know the special place. He doesn't know how to build the special fire. He doesn't know the special prayer. But he says to himself, maybe just the memory that there was a fire will be sufficient, and the community will be saved. And indeed it was. And I bring this up to say that my best hope is that the memory, it's a story about memory. And I think one of the profound things that music does for people, and particularly the American dream, is it inculcates and preserves this sense of memory of who we are and what we're about. And even if we get lost, and even if we wander so far from the path that we can't remember who we are anymore, maybe just the memory that there was a time when we were one people, more or less, will be sufficient. And, you know, I do see kind of glimmers here and there. You know, one of the problems with the internet and the digital life is that it's everywhere and it's nowhere. There's no there. You're not connected. People are floating freely. And I think it creates anxiety among people. And I think eventually it's going to have its opposite effect, that people are going to realize that community is more important, that place is more important, that small is more important. You can have $1 billion, but when the meteor hits, when we all turn to particles, then we're all in space, you know? I mean, ultimately the end game is that we are together.
And so, and is it music then that can take us there, both back into that story and that common shared memory, but also physically bring us together? Because music is physical.
I do believe this. You know, sometimes I have this vision of 10,000 years ago, the people were in a cave, right? And there was a fire and they were dancing around the fire and there's some sounds outside that are scary. And that somebody starts clapping and then somebody else starts hitting a couple of things together. And the next thing you know, there's a chant going and people, and that's the roots of religion. That's the roots of how we came to believe that there was something bigger than us as individuals and that we were a part. It's called collective entrainment. And you know, humans are the only animals that can be collectively entrained by an outside source. Or to put it better, only humans can clap on 2 and 4.
I want to go to one more song that in a way is about all of this. You refer to it as being a song that's about going into the dark woods together. It's the song by, I think, your favorite composer, right? Harold Arlen and Yip Harburg, and a song that almost didn't make it into the movie.
Yeah. It's the song Over the Rainbow. And Harold Arlen is my favorite 20th century composer because he was such a great piano player. And he was so connected to the Stride piano players of Harlem and to the Cotton Club where he worked. And he was a jazz musician at his heart, but also a great 32-bar song man and somebody who pushed the form, who wrote songs that were out of the form. And Yip Harburg, of course, who wrote Brother, Can You Spare a Dime? Yip Harburg came up with the rainbow in the Wizard of Oz. Originally, the story didn't have a rainbow in it. And that was a device that Harburg came up with. And Harburg also came up with the device where at the end the wizard, gives the cowardly lion the courage. But he had it all along. And the Tin Woodsman, I guess, got the heart. But he had heart all along. You know, it's this idea that, well, here's a medal. But we've carried with us all along everything that we need.
Somewhere Over the Rainbow.
Somewhere over the rainbow, way off. That I heard of once in a lullaby. Somewhere over the rainbow, skies are blue, and the dreams that you dare to dream really do come true. Someday I'll wish upon a star and wake up where the clouds are far behind me, where troubles melt like lemon drops away above the chimney tops. That's where you'll find me. Somewhere over the rainbow,
such a great song.
Yeah, and as you say, it almost didn't get in the movie. It was rejected like five times until Harold Arlen and Yip Harburg walked into the office of the executives there and said, you must put this song in the movie, and they finally agreed to it.
You know, we were talking, Ben, one of our callers brought up the fact that she celebrated both Easter and Passover. And I'm curious about your feelings about this question of now the Seder almost becoming sort of ubiquitous. President mm-hmm. Obama has it at the White House. Mm-hmm. And what you make of that, and whether or not you feel like, since being a Jew is in part about being the other, and I don't know. I guess I'm just wondering whether that's a good thing or whether or not there's a challenge in that to sort of, how do you stay apart if you're being incorporated into the East Room of the White House?
That's right. That's right. A little alienation is a good thing, and when you lose it, what happens? I'm reminded there's a book called The Jew in the Lotus written by Roger Kamenetz, and it discusses a journey that a bunch of Jewish people from the United States make to Dharamsala. They've been invited by the Dalai Lama, who is interested in the idea of how to maintain culture in the face of diaspora, because obviously the Tibetans are having this experience right now. And he thinks that the Jews might have some information on this subject because they've been in diaspora for so many years and yet their culture is intact. So he invites them to come. And the book describes their journey and their discussions. And they decide that at the heart of the reason the Jews have been able to sustain themselves in diaspora is because of the Passover Seder. Because the Passover Seder says to everybody, you too were once a slave in Egypt. And it puts the children at the heart of the service. The children are the most important parts of the service. They ask the most important questions. And there are aspects of what we once considered peculiarly Jewish that are now very American. You know, the joke is assimilation is not something that's done to the Jews. It's something the Jews do to other people. But if you look at America today, it has in many ways become Jewishified, if you will. Not just that everybody speaks some Yiddish and everybody's out eating bagels, but Jews are accepted now in a way in America that they've never been accepted. Really, if you read the history anywhere else, it's just remarkable. And yes, there is a question: what does this mean for the survival of what the Jewish experience has been? And if we lose that, will we in fact have a Jewish experience? Or will the Jewish experience be reduced to the Hasidic experience because the birth rate among Hasids is very high and the birth rate among secular Jews, Reform Jews, is not even 2. It's like 1.4. So there are people concerned on all fronts about this. What do I think? I think if anybody can convert, that everybody has an inner Jew. And I think what we're talking about is this great narrative that started 3,000 years ago, this story, as I said at the beginning. You know, we worship a narrative. And this narrative is a universal narrative. And, of course, it's been interpreted many ways by many people. But basically at the heart of the narrative, at the heart of the monotheistic experience, is if I can have a relationship with a higher cause and you can have a relationship with a higher cause, then you and I are equal. We both have our own relationship with the higher cause. And I think that that aspect of it is probably the most profound aspect of the Jewish experience. And so the Jewish experience may not survive in terms of the dietary laws, or it may be completely reduced to everybody having to wear payas and black hats. But what we're talking about here is not that. It's not the forms. It's something deeper.
Yeah.
And I believe it lives.
Ben Sidran, the book again, There Was a Fire, Jews, Music, and the American Dream. Ben, such a pleasure to have you on our program this morning. Thank you.
Thank you, David. My pleasure, really.
Ben will be at Yoshi's next Wednesday in Oakland and at Sweetwater's in Marin on Thursday. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Amanda Stupai is our engagement producer. Online help from David Marks. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Dan Zoll is our engineer. And Dan Zoll is our senior editor, rather. Raul Ramirez, our executive producer. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Sing hallelujah, come on, get happy. We're headed for the judgment.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.